Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safari.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and welcome back to perhaps the final of our Biennale episodes. It's been a while since we were there, but the memories are still fresh. Live with us forever. In previous episodes, we covered the international exhibition curated by Leslie Lacco. We talked about the metaverse in the Albanian pavilion and the artists of Ludi. And now we're back with our mega stuffed to the gills episode on the national pavilions. And we've got a couple of great interviews with some of the curators of the Latvian and Canadian pavilions coming up. And also, before we get into it, I want to give a special shout out to our Biennale mate, now and forever, Alexander Siebenthal of Recite from Prague. Alex was there with us recording several of the curators with us and for her own podcast, Design in the City, which she'll have forthcoming episodes later. But anyway, let's get into it, Dan. It's like we're doing basically, we drafted our pavilions beforehand in terms of how we want to talk about them. So we're going to see how many pavilions we can cover in an hour or less. So with that, the number one pick, Dan, what are you taking? Maybe not your favorite, but your number one pick.
It definitely is the one I wanted to make sure I talked about, which again is kind of a front runner from previous Biennale is Austria. Austria always picks something that's very topical and a little bit uncomfortable for the architecture community to talk about, and they did it once again this year. So this year's theme was participation was the title, and basically the idea was that it took the history of the Biennale grounds itself, the Giardini, as a kind of proxy for the world about democracy and access and accessibility, and basically noted how the public park that was the Arsenale is becoming less and less public over time as it becomes more and more about the Biennale. In fact, all of Venice itself has become more and more about the Biennale, and they presented it almost as a kind of colonization. And the way that they dealt with it spatially was to attempt to illegally build the stairs over the fence that actually surrounds the Giardini. They petitioned the Biennale organization several times and were turned down. And the end of the exhibition was basically, the solution was basically that they built the stairs halfway up and then it becomes a viewing platform outside of the boundaries. But it was this kind of statement about, okay, if this is supposed to be about the democratic display of of national artistic and architectural pride, why is this increasingly being taken away from the public, the shrinking public, which is the citizens of Venice itself?
Yeah. No, as journalists, you know, of course we love the trope of like, well, your idea has been squashed by the Biennale, so let's just print the correspondence that they got from Freedom of Information requests, basically. So I did enjoy the part of the display was the notion of like, here's our actual being quashed by the Biennale itself. So everyone loves a good meta reference there. Well, speaking of meta references and speaking of Biennale meta references, I'll take as my first discussion point the Swiss Pavilion, Switzerland, which covered their awesome tote bag in the past, but their entire concept of neighbors, as it was to basically open up and knock down a wall between the Swiss Pavilion and the Venezuelan Pavilion. So this is total deep cut Biennale here. They're the only two national pavilions that shared a wall. And, you know, it goes way back. I won't even try to cover it all, but, you know, Switzerland's was designed by Bruno Giacometti and Venezuela done by Carlos Scarpa. And, you know, there's all sorts of like deep cuts there where I think, what is it, Venezuela left the Swiss Pavilion like a tiny window in the wall to see the Grand Canal. But in any case, the Venezuela Pavilion was open for the first time, I think, in several Biennales. I was shocked to actually see it there. Last time we were there in 21, Dan, it was a windswept ruin. There was trash collecting there. So it was nice to see a very bare bones, but, you know, there was a sort of National University of Caracas over in the Venezuelan Pavilion. So the Swiss went over there. And I'll end this with this. I mean, formally very interesting of, you know, discussing the relationship between the two. But the souvenir I wanted most in the Biennale was the giant carpet in the Swiss Pavilion that had the blueprints of the combined pavilions on it. So, you know, someday when I have, I don't know how many square meters it was a giant room. But yes, having plush carpeting with the blueprints drawn on it was a very nice flex. So that's what I've got. Up next, what do you got? Korea, Dan.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we had fun in there, didn't we? So when I say we, I mean me filming Greg and Greg hitting all the buttons at once as hard as he could, reliving his game show glories of past years.
Before you get into the game show, though, let's cover it. So we, you know, we'll hear from the Canadian curators later. I mean, you know, we visited Canada first and thought that, you know, as you'll hear, it's a very radical pavilion, you know, for housing politics. But man, no, you want politics that go hard? Korea's went hard. 2086, together how? Question mark. Dan, how will we live together in 2086 in the Korean dystopia?
Apparently, we will be facing some very stark choices. Like, are we going to try to bomb all the eco-terrorists before they bomb us? Should we just give in to all of the industrial companies and let them run rampant over the earth? And I don't even remember what the middle ground was, but it wasn't great either. It was like, we're faced with a bunch of terrible choices. And then they had this game show format set up where you basically would sit with buzzers trying to select what you think was the least terrible of your choices.
And that Together How game, which I thought was interesting, again, sort of mechanics of this is they're going to collect that data points and there will be some sort of output deliverable here of, you know, casting yourself as the CEO of Exxon Monsanto or whatever it was there and figuring out, like, you know, do you give in to the terrorist demands or do you take out the eco-terrorists? It was a trip, to say the least.
I mean, it's almost like Korea took the Squid Game and just kind of applied it to, you know, decisions about the climate and environment.
Yes, it was intense, to say the least. Well, speaking of sort of visualization and dystopia here, I want to pivot over to the Netherlands. So shout out to, you know, my friend Eric Chen, who was the commissioner for the pavilion. Good for him. And the curator was Jan Jongert. And, you know, the Dutch pavilion, and I think this is sort of interesting, it was a series of drawings by the architect Carlin Kingma. And this is, I think, an example of where, for the Patrick Schumachers of the world, who are like, where is the architecture? It was a beautiful, I don't know, we could say, you know, Boschian perhaps, or Escher-esque, but the series of collections to visualize global capital flows as flows of water. A conceptually sound, and, you know, just painting the pavilion with these mostly the sort of these epic drawings of cascading water and reservoirs. And it was, I mean, I guess I would say it was lovely. And it was fascinating to look at how derivatives factored in and how they sort of charted it out. But yeah, I mean, always a highlight. I think the Netherlands from 2018 with their sort of clockwork orange-esque motifs was one of my all-time favorite national pavilions. But I did think it was interesting where, again, we were sort of reflecting on, like, where's the architecture? It struck me as a better art biennale one, but we'll see. But speaking of conceptually interesting, Dan, USA.
Okay, well, you know, the USA Pavilion is always kind of a wild card, and it kind of played that card again. I would say that this time we're basically joining the sort of, you know, global, shall we say, reconciliation with our past, or our present, I should say, which is producing a ton of plastic. The United States Pavilion was called Everlasting Plastics, and basically the concept was to take all the plastics that have been produced and try to make them into something 3D, I think to kind of underscore the fact that they could be used as building materials because gosh knows they last. But it was a little bit cynical. I think it was mostly, it worked well as critique, but again, it was sort of questioning, I don't know how many practical solutions there were that could be turned into architecture or could be turned into mass production. I mean, I've definitely heard it said that, you know, it's not so much that all plastics are bad and we shouldn't be using them. We're just putting them in the wrong things. We're putting them in disposable items that we throw away after a single use. But the problem is that buildings don't last. And I would have liked to have seen more application about, okay, so how can we stream plastics into buildings so that they do last longer and we don't have to tear them down, which is, in a way, sustainable.
Absolutely. And so that's a great segue into my next pavilion. They sort of like, how do we think about these sort of feedback loops and capturing it? So, which is, of course, a theme which we'll get back to some of the other national pavilions and something that Leslie Lacco asked the national pavilions to think about. But I want to highlight the Kingdom of Bahrain curators Mariam El-Jamari and Latifa Al-Kayat. I'm probably mangled their names. We did have a chance to speak at length with Mariam and Latifa, recent MIT School of Architecture graduates who won the open call for that. We'll have an interview with them over at Alex's podcast, Design in the City, at some point. But they took this great standpoint of for Bahrain of sweating assets, which they were touched that I actually understood the reference to sweating the asset, the idea of maximizing your available resource, sort of milking a cash cow in a way. But in this case, sweating assets refers to air conditioning. And they took a very, I think, great approach of looking at how do you harness the moisture and humidity generated by AC units and think about that as an invisible potentially capturable reservoir of water that would lessen the need for desalinization and, of course, other water needs in the water-stressed Gulf. And so an interesting exploration of, you know, AC as infrastructure and as distributed infrastructure and how to capture that. And I thought it was a great approach, considering that we think so much these days about distributed solar generation, et cetera. What about distributed capturing of that? So, yeah, great explorations there. But, yeah, there were some strong entries from the GCC this year. UAE, Dan, that was one of your favorites or notables.
I did enjoy that, and not just because of the bag. It was a lovely bag with nice several different languages and caricatures, and it was very nicely rendered in red. And
all comes back to the totes. Bahrain beige. Had a good one, too. Yeah,
yeah, but it wasn't just about the bags. It was also addressing the idea of, okay, these are desert countries. Let's deal with the reality of the fact that people really do live in desert. There's a fact in here that 32% of the Earth's surface is semi-arid or arid. So let's grapple with that reality instead of trying to deny it by putting in, conditioned space and boiling the ocean, as it were. So it showed some really interesting historical attempts to deal with it, you know, earthen materials, practices that the construction industry right now doesn't really take seriously because we have concrete, but they're arguing that perhaps we should. And maybe we would be able to have develop more of a modern contemporary vernacular for these parts of the world that, to be fair, people have inhabited for millennia. And it's so I think they want to sort of push back against the idea that, well, the desert's uninhabitable and we have to forge a Western style, air conditioned, completely tempered lifestyle against it, like we're colonizing the moon. But, you know, it's not the moon. We can live there. It's just we have to adapt to something that's environmentally appropriate. So I thought that was a good theme.
Well, that is. I skipped something out of order here. I want to talk about the Victoria and Albert Museum Pavilion, which is neither part of the international exhibition nor quite national, but we'll substitute it for Britain in this case. Because the entire theme there was exactly that, tropical modernism, looking at the historical movement to basically design a modernity of architecture designed for sub-Saharan Africa. And I think we covered this slightly in our discussion of the Neon Pavilion, but it's sort of breathtaking to me that, you know, that you could have in the same Biennale, something like the UAE, taking that tradition and carrying it forward, Neon going back to it. But yeah, the idea of that sort of tropical modernity, being adopted as a political project by Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, and taking this and trying to actually create a new vernacular form for this. And, you know, and again, it's just absolutely wild to see history repeat where, you know, a school of British architects go into a literal colony and colonize it with their own form of sort of adapted architecture only to become part of a political project and then doomed when Kwame Nkrumah is overthrown. So, man, I would say when, you know, the Biennale doesn't repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes. But speaking of, you know, colonialism and extraction, Australia was another highlight. And again, Alex will have an interview with the Australia curator over Design in the City, but yeah, what were your thoughts there, Dan?
Australia's title was Unsettling Queenstown, and it was superimposed with Unsettling Questions. And the way that it was positioned was to really look at the expropriation of land from their first peoples and the displacements of the settler populations from the ancestral motherlands. Basically, come to Jesus about the wealth that they've gained from extracting from nature and from indigenous people. And so what they ended up doing was commissioning most of the top names in architecture in Australia to create these little pamphlets, which you could then tear off the wall and take with you, which describe these small villages that they referred to as Queenstowns as a kind of a generic proxy for colonial architecture and colonialism. And then it reimagined a way that they could be less extractive, less colonial, less domineering.
Interesting. All right, and then next pavilion is also yours here, Germany. I would say I'm the Germans. The last Biennale, they just put up a QR code, so this was definitely an improvement. But what did the Germans do this time?
Well, yeah, if I may say so, I think of this as a kind of almost a Bildungsroman about Germany's relationship kind of to the Biennale and to just the practices that are conducted in order to create the Biennale. There's a lot of building and deconstruction that goes on. So what they ended up doing was basically deconstructing their own pavilion, including excavating portions of it and putting in parts that had been disassembled from the previous art biennale. So it was called Relocating a Structure, or Open for Maintenance. I won't even attempt the German pronunciation here either, which was all very well and good, except that it was almost exactly a copy of the Japanese pavilion from the prior biennale, which looked at the deconstruction of houses in Japan and sold them off as artifacts.
Yeah, conceptually different, but still the idea like, hey, we dismantled this thing, we tagged every item of this thing, and by the way, would you like to make a tote bag with the leftover pieces? The Germans were doing that one. It was definitely much a thinking face emoji for me, yeah. The Germans came from this notion, I think, again, listening to Leslie Locko a little too literally for my taste there, in the sense of, what is this biennale for? Why is it so wasteful? Why do we do anything? I would say as a corollary to that, you know, I would go to the Uzbekistan pavilion of like how to do it right. So, you know, so again, as we discussed, you know, in the international exhibition, lots of screens, lots of media, a lot less models, which are, of course, costly to build and ship and et cetera, and dismantle. But Uzbekistan did a lovely one. In their particular case, it was called Unbuild Together, and it was sort of this sort of looking at archaism versus modernity. And for the Uzbeks, it was great. It was basically the pavilion was the output of what sounded to me like the student workshop of a lifetime, where, you know, basically an architecture studio traveled Uzbekistan by train, visited Tashkent, where they met master brick glazers and craftsmen. And the pavilion is a labyrinth built out of locally sourced bricks, of which Venice has no end of supply. And then, you know, as you wander through the labyrinth in, you know, ambient music and a darkened room, they actually have this huge space at the very end of the Arsenale on your way to the Italy and China pavilions. And it was, you know, incredibly atmospheric, and you would round the corner and come across like these beautifully glazed bricks embedded into the wall. And then the centerpiece was a film, basically sort of discussing, like, again, their own explorations as Uzbeks into their own past as architects discussing this. And it was just lovely. It was exactly the kind of thing that I personally go to the Biennale for, of like this sort of evoking not just, you know, and the intellect, but moods and emotions and sort of creating this physical experience. And why I think ultimately it's worthwhile to go to the Biennale. So I saw that as a, you know, maybe not as a direct rebuke, but as restoring my faith in the Biennale. And speaking of, you know, going, I guess sort of circling back here, we've got a couple more pavilions. You know, I want to get into the Czech Republic one. The Czechs really did a great job, again, like the Austrians, and it's that Mitteleuropa thing, I guess, here, of calling out the Biennale. In this case, well, the Czechs called out architecture itself, dealing with the whole addressing sort of precarity here, the office for a non-precarious future. So I won't get too deep into it because, as you can expect, it's really about challenging the architecture practice as a form itself. But what really stood out to me as a groundbreaking aspect for the Biennale, it was the first pavilion I've ever seen that had memes and that had sourced actual memes for it here. So, and they were quite good ones. I don't have the photos handy, but, you know, it was interesting to actually invite actual like architect memesters to imagine, you know, memes as an organizing principle. And by organizing, I mean organizing labor, not organizing the actual pavilion itself. So that was interesting. And then, you know, again, we talk about memes. Let's get to Latvia. As you are probably aware, if you were listening to this and gotten this far into a podcast about the Biennale, Latvia is probably the hit of the show. Ollie Wainwright loved it and others. And, you know, that's because it got extremely meta. This is the pavilion tucked inside the Arsenale, in, you know, where a lot of the national pavilions are simply very small rooms. And Latvia knocked it out of the park by creating a basically supermarket of ideas, literally the marketplace of ideas. And in this case, they took, I think, the last 10 Biennales, 20-plus years of architecture, and rendered it as products you could put into a shopping cart. And you know, as we'll hear from the curator, from one of our curators in just a moment here, Ernest Zerbulis, you'll hear about basically the concepts of how they used AI to generate the product. So rather than having me describe it to you, let's cut to the interview with him to discuss with Alex and I there present about Latvia's thinking of this. And, you know, if it isn't apparent in the subtext of my questions, I was literally trying to ask him, like, do you hate the Biennale? Like, what is the premise of this? So let's hear him explain.
Special All right, we're here in the Latvian Pavilion, which is a supermarket of ideas, truly a marketplace of ideas. All of the many discarded ideas over 10 years, 21 years of Biennales across 10 Biennales. And we are here with the curator, the man. I asked to speak to the manager, and this is who they brought to us. So could you please introduce yourself?
Welcome to TCL. I'm Sam Engelis. I'm an architect and curator of this pavilion. So yeah, I think you get the pavilion very right. And what we did, we collected 506 previous pavilions presented in Biennale, and we thought that it's worth to give the ideas second chance, because ideas needs the second chance. Let's say there are great pavilions from the previous years, what maybe wasn't noticed then, but now it's time to, let's say, have it again and see them again. And why it's so colorful and happy, let's say our everyday profession is very kind of demanding, and but still we somehow love it. We still love the architecture, and we just wanted to play and celebrate these 10 years and this kind of bunch of ideas and this gathering at Venice. So yeah.
Well, I think, not to get too meta, but like, how do you feel about the Biennale? You're kind of making a giant mockery out of the Biennale, which kind of needs to be mocked if looking at this scene. So, yeah, how did you approach this, given that you're at the Biennale?
I mean, we are celebrating architecture. Really, we are celebrating architecture, and we don't want to be, let's say, and we kind of create, our supermarket is kind of a mirror of Biennale. And each kind of visitor, each customer of our shop or our store can perceive through their own kind of perspective. You can be experimental, you can be critical. Why there is so many ideas and why they don't get to the customers? I mean, why there is this gap between architecture and people? Everyone can raise their own questions and their own experiments. That's what we want to kind of, we want to create, let's say, a communicative platform to talk about things that is important for us. Yeah.
And then how did you arrive at the design of the actual products? Because some of them look a little unreal, perhaps?
Yeah, this was also a kind of a great game. So if we go to the products, let's say they consist of two design parts. Let's say one is visual side, and the second is, let's say, the text or content side. So what we did, we considered each pavilion as a product. So each product has a place of origin. So all products you find origin, let's say, I don't know, Finland, Germany, States, Canada, whatever. We kept the original name of the pavilion as it was presented in Biennale in that time. And then we fed 10 books, 10 previous catalogs of Biennales to AI. And we condensed the author's original text into very kind of short descriptions. So we did a good homework. So now AI hopefully knows better about architecture and Biennales. So I think we did a good job in that sense. And also the second part was graphic-wise. So we divided our store in 10 departments, let's say. 10 parts, so we have all the products like you find in everyday shop, like milk products, I don't know, cleaning products, chips, frozen products, drinks, and soft drinks, and vegetables, of course. And so we understood that it's like we are very far from the entrance of Biennale, and people may get quite let's say intellectually exhausted of so many ideas. So we wanted to, let's say, to feel the people, the visitors, very, let's say, calm and easy, like they would enter their home store. And at first you kind of see, oh, it looks like just a store. Why they brought a store? And then there's a possibility to dive into these ideas and explore the designs, which are also kind of quite crazy. And as I said in the beginning, it's also about, let's say, each own's perspective. So we use AI as a tool a lot for the texts, for the graphic design. And we're kind of, someone could ask a question, okay, AI is quite good with texts, AI is quite good with images. I mean, it's a few steps away from being very good with spaces also. So what we are left with at the end? So that's why we have these white balls. So what we are left with is our decisions. Or recipes, what we want to cook, I mean, what we want to kind of prepare, because the shop has all the kind of products, but it depends on you. your decision kind of matters, your recipe matters. Either you want to cook paella or burger or fish, you go for the products which is kind of matters to you. So you somehow influence this process. And that's and we also kind of think that Biennale still have to be, let's say, an experimental place and a place where we get inspired, where we get new ideas out of it. It's not just like placing your best product. It's kind of, it should be kind of very involving, including the people. People should. That's what we expect from Biennale.
I love the idea. I hope over the course of the 6 months, you actually take. Either go to IBM Watson, which once made a cookbook, so go back to an AI, but ask an AI to make meals and then take the products from here and mash them together to see what bizarre ideas come out as the finished meals from the AI. The possibilities are endless. All right, last question. What would your speech be if you win the Golden Lion?
Oh my God. I hope we would get a cardboard lion because we use the cardboard as a kind of sustainable material for the design of the shelves. I don't know. I think we love architecture and we want to celebrate that, and we're very happy to be here and proud to, let's say, bring our country here and be part of this. Which is another thing, we have these 10 departments because we are in Biennale for the 10 times since 2002. And it's a small anniversary and we want to kind of celebrate that. Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you. We're going to grab a 6-pack from Free Space and some yogurt milk from How We Will Live Together. And I would encourage listeners to vote for How Will We Live Together. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Supermarket, I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for the special offer.
Let's talk about Estonia.
Yeah, it was the perfect segue to the Latvians. I would say if you actually pick up the Latvian catalog, they, a circulated shopper where you could look at the products here. In the back, there's an ad for their Baltic neighbors, Estonia. And Estonia, I have to say, probably is the one that maybe broke my heart in the best way. So Estonia was a satellite pavilion. It was an actual apartment they rented. And, as you sort of round the Arsenali, as you exit out of it and start walking your way back to the Giardini, you come across the apartment. And there's sort of someone sitting outside. And you may enter the apartment, but first, Dan, you must sign a short-term stay agreement to enter it, in which case you promise that you will... The proprietor hereby allows the guest to spend a certain period of their probably one and only lifetime in a furnished apartment, the property located at the address there. The term allows you an hour and a half max. You can never enter again. Access is free. You can neither damage nor improve the property, etc. And as you enter it, taking your shoes off as you enter, you find a home that has been stripped of all of its domesticity, where literally there are boxes on the walls on the home that are labeled dreams and ideals and must-haves. And it was a gut punch, Dan. It was a gut punch on several levels. Gut punch for me in the sense of, just personally, someone, still in the midst of getting divorced who sold off my home, the dreams and ideals you place into the home itself and what you embody there. But obviously it was a bigger commentary on Airbnb and, of course, short-term stay and, that whole process of self-financialization that Airbnb and, the growth of that industry has really done. And I would say that the moment where it was like a really like hot iron in my stomach, I love that, I thought really underscored this. We talk about Neom as dystopian, but like the Estonian one was really the most dystopian and they knew it. So they have on the refrigerator tacked up a short little paragraph that people have edited while they're there. And I'll try to read it quickly. It's titled Dystopias. Whenever a dystopian story wants to illustrate the destruction of the world as it once was, the simplest approach seems to be showing a street with a couple of burned-out cars or a couple dozen burned-out cars. In addition to everyday items that were flung from houses, a mattress or two, for instance, or it may be rooms that are now faded or soot-stained or burnt, it is the world without hug, to quote that Danish of hig, for Americans. But coziness doesn't happen all on its own. It must be carefully constructed over years and years. My home is my castle. The easiest way to create a dystopian atmosphere is to show a version of the world where not one home is a castle anymore. That would be fitting for our society's final slogan, not one home is a castle anymore. It could be poetic in that notion of property ownership of a castle, but that idea of everything is a financialized node, just stripped down to it. I thought the Estonians really nailed that. And that is the perfect segue for our final pavilion and final interview, my absolute favorite of the entire time, perhaps due to my emigre's pride, Canada. But Dan, how was Canada?
Yeah, Canada was brilliant in the sense that it was probably the most coherent and focused of the, let's call them protest pavilions in the whole Giardini. It was called Not For Sale. And the concept there was basically that financialization is just the latest arrow in the side of sustainable living and equality. But it's been part of a long, long legacy of displacement and people not being able to, you know, establish homes and being constantly in hock to the financial gods that rule real estate, in addition to the inherited inequalities of colonialism. So it had some great, great iconography, including the acronym AAHA, which is Architects Against Housing Alienation, comes off as AHA, and it appears as a bald fist in the shape of the silhouette of a house, which makes for a great icon and almost a sort of Soviet constructivist or propaganda poster. But it was a really... it was a really coherent pavilion because it actually had mission statements. It had actually, they were characterized as demands. And they explained the demands quite clearly. You know, perhaps you could judge about whether, what kind of expectations they had to see those demands fulfilled. But it was just very clearly articulated where so many pavilions are, you know, obtuse or abstract or they're kind of dancing around the issue. This one went straight for the jugular.
No, absolutely. I would say I should note, you know, AHA was the collective form of this. And as you'll hear in a moment, you know, because we have interviews coming up here with two of the curators, there's six curators as part of AHA. You're going to hear from Adrian Blackwell and Matthew Souls, a tape there. But yeah, it's been criticized. I actually had a chance to chat with Alex Bozakovic, the Globe and Mail's architecture critic, who I think gave it sort of a mixed review. He found it overstuffed, but I thought that was kind of the point. I mean, it was very maximalist as a pavilion. I love the fact that there were protest signs you could make outside. It's quasi-occupation. They're bringing students through again, which, again, loving making it an activated space. As we discussed on the previous episode on the Saturday, they brought together Indigenous leaders and representatives of the 10 groups that funded it, and hearing them talk about this issue and then going to listen to Cook at the Neon Pavilion is, like, the greatest cognitive dissonance there. But anyway, here we are, telling instead of showing. So in this particular case, let's cut to our interview on site with Matthew and Adrian to hear them explain in their own words the ideas and concepts behind this idea of land back, not for sale. All right, we're here at the Biennale at the Canadian Pavilion, Not For Sale. I'm here with one of the curators, Matthew Souls. We'll be joined shortly by one of his other ones, Adrian, as well. But Matthew, could you start, of course, by introducing to our listeners who you are, the theme for the pavilion, and, yeah, how this came about to have such a real radical premise. And here's Adrian now to join as well, so he'll introduce himself in a second.
Okay, so, my name is Matthew Souls. I'm an architect and professor based in the city currently called Vancouver, which is the traditional territory of the Coast Salish peoples. I'm a settler in that stolen land. I'm one of six co-curators, co-organizers of the Not For Sale campaign. The Not For Sale campaign started about a year ago. We are occupying the Canada Pavilion as not our headquarters, but our heart quarters. We're here for 6 months, but it's one moment in a larger campaign that started before the Biennale and will continue for years after the Biennale. At the heart of the campaign, we have a manifesto and 10 demands. Those 10 demands were generated by 10 regionally based teams, two from Vancouver, one from the north, one from the prairies, three from Toronto, two from Montreal, and one from Halifax. Each team is composed of an architect, a housing activist organization, and a housing advocacy organization. In some cases, the advocacy person, it's an individual. We were really excited about how these different expertise and different viewpoints could come together and work synergistically with each other, learn from each other, and generate kind of new thinking around the housing problems in Canada, around the questions of decommodification, decolonization, and challenging financialization. So really, this campaign is led by their ideas from the bottom up. We as an organizing committee, we're just a vehicle for their insights and their intelligence. And when you go into the campaign heart quarters, it's a place to engage with all of this unique content and unique ideas that all address certain things that are common to across Canada, because of course the housing problems span the entire country and most of the entire world, but they reflect their individual particular context.
Question that is from the two of you is if you could call out, I think, some of those actions of the 10 demands, or perhaps the ones that are nearest and closest to your own hearts, or thinking about the unique geographies of it. So, you know, obviously one of them, I think, is, you know, return all of the so-called crown lands to the Indigenous peoples, and particularly a concern in the far north. But in Montreal, it's very much about mutual aid housing. I mean, Canada contains multitudes. I say that as a Canadian resident myself. And so I'm curious, like, how do you bring all of these aspects of Canadian geography and its peoples together to create a cohesive plan, or how do you see those pieces fitting together over the 6 months?
Hi, my name is Adrian Blackwell. I'm a professor at the University of Waterloo, which is located on the Haldimand Tract, which is land that was promised to the Six Nations of the Grand River, and is now home to, and has been home to, the Attawandaron, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. So I think to talk about how these demands work across the country, one of the fundamental ideas in the exhibition is that there's a continuity between Indigenous housing problems in Canada today and settler housing problems in Canada today. And those have been generated through the kind of combined problems of capitalism and colonialism. And they are very related to the problems that are happening in cities today are deeply intertwined with the problem of Indigenous land dispossession. So the violence of that dispossession lives on in Canadian cities. So the exhibition really tries to begin with these demands that focus on Indigenous housing, and then continues to think about how urban problems are built on top of those problems that Indigenous people suffer from. So that's one of the kind of really binding elements of the exhibition. We thought a lot about how to arrange these demands, and also, I mean, I think, as Matthew says, they come purely from the teams, but at the same time, I think, as a curatorial and organizing committee, we've been very interested in how to shape 10 demands that cover a broad range of issues across the country. So that's been part of our job, is to focus, first of all, to choose teams that are focusing on diverse issues, but also issues which overlap and together bring out the fundamental problems of housing in the nation.
Yeah, so you plan to have, obviously, over the 6 months, you know, multiple student teams and multiple convenings here. You've already had the first bringing together all sort of 10 of those groups. What do you hope to have by the end of it? I mean, I've always been impressed by the pavilions that treat it not just as an exhibition static for 6 months, but these kinds of living laboratories. But what do you think you can practically achieve here in the Giardini of the Biennale?
But in all instances, we see it really as important work that gives momentum and added depth and strength to realizing the demands over this kind of multi-year effort.
Great. Well,
I think like the students are a kind of a catalyst to keep momentum moving over the next 6 months. But I think the campaign is far beyond the students, too. I mean, each of these organizations is concretely working to realize their own demands. And so, as Matthew says, the students are augmenting that work. So, and I think as Architects Against Housing Alienation, we've got a lot of work to do to kind of consolidate what was a movement that has been focused on an exhibition into something that can move beyond that. So there's a lot of work to do from different parties. And the students are one part of that that's very important during the duration of the exhibition. But I think the longer project is going to substantively involve these groups and hopefully a lot of other groups who are similarly motivated and have just as much expertise as the groups that we've brought into this project here. But there are many other groups across Canada, of course, who are addressing issues of housing alienation, and we would love to talk to them and meet with them and try to bring them into this movement too.
Great. Well, I guess the last question is the obvious one here at the Architecture Biennale, which is how do you see the role of architecture in particular playing into these challenges? Because two of the demands that stood out for me are like gentrification tax, no more surplus housing. I mean, those are great policy. I totally agree with both of those policy prescriptives. But what do you think particularly architects can bring to the conversation at this point, who have been trying to make a difference in the commodification of housing for a long time? And I saw, as a Montreal resident, I mean, there were some great sections there about imagining mutual aid and multi-programmatic housing. Where do you think architecture has the chance to make the greatest difference in the Canadian housing crisis?
Of course, housing buildings are always by necessity designed by architects. And those architects are always working in a complex milieu, whether they directly confront and interact with that milieu or kind of choose not to think about it. We believe strongly that for architects to play a positive role, which we believe they absolutely can and must, they must work synergistically with diverse expertise and find kind of new forms of conversation and new ways of kind of pulling in information and factors and inform the designs and the physicality in this way. There's a continuum between taxation structures, land ownership structures, and what a kitchen layout is. We often don't think about it, but we believe it's an absolute central role for architects to play, but it's playing this role in tandem with all these other important kind of experts within this complex milieu.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that we're trying to see architects as crucial, but within a much more complex set of actors. And so trying to think of architects not as the people who necessarily lead the whole thing, but who can work with and be activists. So I think another important part of this campaign is to understand the necessity of politicizing architects. Mm. That this is not just a matter of, you know, building more housing. It's about building specific kinds of housing. And so I think that the studios are crucial for that, because they're activist studios. They're teaching students to think about not just how to get the next job, but how to shape policies and frameworks in which good forms, good jobs appear, and you can make architecture which is meaningful around housing issues. But I also think we're doing that with the teams too. I mean, these architects have been working on social housing for a long time. But even in that context, I think working closely with activists and housing activists changes the way they see architecture too. So I think we're trying to ask serious questions about the structure, or what we call the housing system. So in our manifesto, we say we want to abolish the housing system. And I think we want architects to understand that and feel that and think that way and practice to do that, which is a tall order when you're trying to get a job in practice. But we need more diverse ways of thinking about housing. It's not just about building more condominiums. Like, we have to think about the policies behind it, and we're trying to build a culture where architects are pushing and asking those questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, gentlemen. Congratulations again on the pavilion to you and the curatorial team and to AAHA, and can't wait to see what you guys come up with next.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay for me. Stay for me. Is there a reasoning?
So, Greg, having speed run through all of this in reality and now again on this recording, What's your big takeaway from the 2023 Venice Architecture Biennale?
Oh, man. Well, I think going back to, like, going back to Leslie Locko and the main exhibition, Laboratory of the Future, I mean, I think we all agreed at the time that, like, obviously the core themes, decolonization, resource extraction, and, you know, seeing this Australian pavilion did that well, Bahrain, I think we talked about these ones that really focused on that. This idea, and Canada too, the crown lands that are really belonging to the First Nations here. The critiques of the Biennale that say it didn't show enough buildings, there wasn't enough about building architecture, I thought completely misses the mark, because this is the Biennale that really, I think, fulfills the arc that started with Alejandra Aravena's Biennale in 2016. You had Free Space, you had How Will We Live Together, and we're getting back to the notion of how do we ethically build anything at all, given that we stole the future from sub-Saharan Africa. You know, when Leslie Locko says the first unit of energy was a slave's body, she's absolutely right. And, like, you look at the monuments of Northern Europe, those are all built on destruction of human life and civilizations to produce the sugar wealth and other things there. So really confronting this. And I think, as we said at the time at the Biennale, we were talking about this, that as an embodied white cishet man, to, like, if you think about this, it will drive you insane. And so therefore we don't think about it, versus the lived experience of people of color across the world who do have to live with it every day. And the Biennale was the first one I've seen that really, I think, addressed this issue of we need to rethink what the future can be, which I think Leslie Locko did with, you know, Olalake and Jafus and the main pavilion. And then I think the national pavilions did a very good job overall of reckoning with their own histories of colonialization and resource destruction and perverse outcomes in the case of the Koreans, et cetera. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what 2025 brings, you know, in the next go round of this, of, like, now, is it time to build? Now, is it, like, do we go into a truly, you know, post-reckoning utopian version? I don't know. What would you like to see in the next Biennale, Dan?
Well, I would actually like to see what the architects and the builders and the citizens in these areas that have been so historically overrun and extracted from actually are able to produce. I think that was what, you know, perhaps there hasn't been much because they've had the future stolen from them. But I would like to see in the next 2 years some kind of indication. I want to hear a bunch of new names. I want to see a bunch of new things that I've never seen before, you know, from sub-Saharan Africa, from the interior of Australia, from the interior of Central Asia, wherever, you know, these injustices have occurred, or wherever the minerals that power the universe, as it were extracted from. Let's see what the people are actually building in these areas. And where's their diaspora now? What are they doing?
And this year was a great start to that. I don't have the name in front of me. That's my other half of the catalog. But, you know, Leslie Locko in the main pavilion, not only did you have David Ajaye and his massive plans for Accra, but you actually had a local, you know, just a good practice that was designing new towns. I believe it was in Cote d'Ivoire. So you actually saw some of these, you know, actual firms grappling with their site issues. And you're right. And I had not heard of them. And that was the best thing about it. Like, you know, down with star architecture, down with the big names, like, surface more of this. So, yeah, the next curator will certainly hopefully have their hands full, like, basically finding, you know, taking Locko, which she did an amazing job with, of young talent, and pushing that even further. So let's hope.
I mean, it's almost like, if I could suggest another title, if this is the laboratory of the future, let's have the factory of the future next.
Yeah. All right, well, there you go. A small order to pay here. Let's reinvent everything in the next 2 years. I can't wait. I can't wait to visit and drink a spritz while we observe it. So up there as well. So, maybe we'll have a surprise in store down the road, but I think that does it.
Indeed. Till next time.